You're listening to the Asia Geopolitics Podcast. This is your host, as always, Ankit Panda, recording from India this time, a little bit of an unusual location.
And this is your co-host, Katie Putz, and I am recording from the middle of the Pacific Ocean on the island of Hawaii. So we've all gotten out of town.
Yeah, I guess we are, in a way, bookending both ends of the so-called Indo-Pacific, Katie. But it's good to be back at a very interesting time in, I guess, our normal hometown, Washington, where there's quite a bit underway. And I'm trying to stay that with a little bit of neutrality, but obviously it's a bit of an interesting time for any of us who work in fields adjacent to policy and foreign affairs. But, you know, I think listeners will hopefully be understanding of the fact that we have spent a lot of time talking about the United States over the last few months on the Asia Geopolitics podcast. But the reason for that is because I honestly don't think there's a bigger story right now in global geopolitics potentially than what's happening in the United States. So, elephant in the room, the second term of Donald Trump kicked off in ways that I don't think were necessarily particularly foreseen by really anybody. I mean, certainly we're seeing a lot happening in Washington that really wasn't apparent before the November 2024 election as being part of the president's agenda. I think a good place to kick off is actually Donald Trump's inaugural address, which, you know, was interesting in many ways. I mean, different from his first address focusing on American carnage. But, you know, Katie, I want to sort of get your thoughts on this. But the foreign policy parts of this inaugural address were really, I think, fair to say, a bit of a curveball, right? Trump doesn't really spend any time talking about what you might expect from a leader who, during his first term, made a name for himself with essentially inaugurating the concept of great power competition and systemic competition with China, you know, talking about things like tariffs and so on and so forth. You know, in his second inaugural, Trump is talking about very kind of 19th century concepts of manifest destiny, about annexing the Panama Canal, going to Mars, just really kind of out there stuff. And so that's kind of the first place to kind of kick this off. I mean, you know, what was your reaction to this very strange inaugural? I mean, you know, we saw some hints of this coming with comments that Trump had made during the transition period. But I think the inaugural address really showed that we were doubling down on what appears to be a fundamentally new period in American, I think it's fair to say, grand strategy.
Yeah, you know, I think some of the things that jumped out to me in the inaugural address is he had this line about, you know, our government can't manage simple crises at home, but is stumbling into a continuing catalog of catastrophic events abroad. There were some of these other sort of hints of, you know, we can't do anything domestically. Why are we out in the world messing with other people's things? That really echoed, I think, criticisms that, you know, if I can use the word enemy, American enemies, American foes have long sort of lambasted the United States with. The United States is wandering around the world, getting involved in everyone else's business, and they shouldn't be doing that. This is sort of something we hear from your Chinas and your Russias. And to hear the U.S. president effectively say that American foreign policy is not serving the United States at all. And then we sort of saw this iterated in that first batch of executive orders, and we'll get more into the implications of that. But that stuff was in the inaugural address, which is just this criticism of the way that the United States has engaged in the world. It comes very clearly from a very nationalistic perspective and is extremely domestic focused. As you said, there wasn't really a lot of direct foreign policy in that inaugural address, other than these I think there are false equivalencies that are being made. You know, we can't handle crises at home, so why are we doing anything abroad? It's nonsense, but it does speak to a certain audience in the United States. I think the United States is not actually an island, but it is very insular at its heart. It's so big that many Americans don't leave it. It doesn't have a lot of neighbors. So it's, you know, and so I think we saw some of this insularity in the phrasings of the speech and the things that it was focused on. So it was definitely a remarkable thing, not something I would have expected to hear from really any other U.S. president.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot to, I think, pull on here, right? I mean, you saw the White House on social media after the inaugural address and the spate of executive orders really kind of using this language of, you know, promises made, promises kept, right? That this idea that the base, the Make America Great Again voter base, gave Donald Trump a mandate to roll back entanglements abroad to focus mm-hmm. on home. And so that was a big theme in the inaugural address. But I think it also speaks to, you pointed to nonsense, which I obviously agree with, but like, there is this notion that the average American, not necessarily even the average MAGA voter per se, just has, mm-hmm. I mean, pervasive misperceptions about the way in which the United States engages with the broader world, right? I think we'll get to the dismantlement of USAID in a second, but like, you know, when you look at what the average American thinks the US spends on foreign aid as a percentage of the federal budget, like orders of magnitude off. Similarly, like, foreign aid going to Ukraine, a big perception that that money is being wholesale, being given to Ukraine in grants, when a lot of that does get spent domestically in mm-hmm. the U.S. Defense industrial base, creating, you know, jobs and economic activity at home. So obviously all of that is fairly, you know, at the level of more wonkish discourse, I guess you could say, but it's made mm-hmm. for just extremely good fuel for this kind of America First agenda. But at the same time, you know, I think the very first days, and I should say here, given how quickly things are moving in Washington, Katie and I are recording this on February 7th. So if you're listening to this after February 7th and something completely out there has happened that contradicts all of this, you'll have to forgive us. Things are moving quickly. But at least, I mean, based on what we've seen in just a little bit over the first 2 weeks, you have kind of this clash between nationalism and primacy, right? I mean, Donald Trump, I think we've also seen with the turn towards tariffs, coercive threats against Canada and Mexico and Denmark, right over Greenland, which we haven't mm-hmm. even mentioned yet. There is this sense that he enjoys leading a powerful country and has this very kind of 19th century mm-hmm. Bismarckian sense almost of spheres of influence, of American territorial expansion in a Jacksonian sense almost. And a lot of that, I think, ultimately clashes with what he's pitching about, you know, reducing entanglements in the world. I mean, you know, we're not going to get into this too much on this podcast, but I think the best example of this is the remarks we just saw from Trump standing alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about the United States essentially annexing Gaza, the largest commitment potentially for U.S. troops and treasure in the Middle East since the invasion of Iraq, right? Very much contradictory to the mm-hmm. nationalist vision. So you have like this topsy-turvy kind of cocktail of things going on in Trump land, a lot of which is coming from Trump, but it does, I mean, seem to be a lot broader, right? I think so. You know, before we get into this though, I do want to maybe talk about one thing, which is the inward focus that we're seeing early on with a lot of what's happening in the United States. So I think this is, just mm-hmm. having talked to some folks from allied countries in recent weeks, this is in a way like very concerning because the U.S. is in many ways like ripping itself apart and dismantling its own competent administrative state, which has implications for American society, implications for the ways in which the U.S. engages with the world. But in a way, it's also for the allies very unexpected because many of them are worrying about the other worst case, which is that Trump comes in with this nationalist instinct and immediately pulls troops out of South Korea, starts, you know, pulling out of NATO or doing some of that stuff that the allies were really worried about. And so have you kind of made sense of that, Katie? I mean, is this something that we should expect to see a pivot on, or are we really seeing, you know, American carnage in a way, part 2.0? I mean, Trump really delivering on what he sort of identified in his first inaugural address that he was just unable to do because he had the so-called adults in the room.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really hard to say. I think you use the word topsy-turvy, and that is certainly how I feel about it. I mean, frankly speaking, you know, domestic turmoil in the United States makes many U.S. partners nervous. And if you pair that with Trump's known penchant to kind of make these inconsistent, erratic, sudden decisions, there's the saying, you know, you throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. It feels like they're just throwing every piece of spaghetti they can find at the wall and seeing what sticks. And the result of throwing spaghetti at the wall is a giant mess. And so, you know, this kind of erratic decision making And frankly, the walking back of U.S. commitments to various things, regardless of what those commitments are, things like leaving the WHO, leaving the Paris Accords again, the sanctions on the ICC, these sort of portray the U.S. as an unreliable partner, because those are things an unreliable partner does. It's hard for any partner of the United States at this point to be certain that what Donald Trump says today is the policy is going to be the policy in 2 weeks, because that's not how he operates. And the people will make arguments that there's a maverick nature to this. There's a plan. I don't see it. And I think certainly in talking to sort of Asian partners and other people in the world who deal with the United States, they're hesitant, right? They don't really know what's coming down the pike. And then the other sort of part I want to focus on in this is this sort of secondary and tertiary effects of those domestic focused policies. Whether they're on immigration or downsizing the federal workforce, those have implications for how the United States engages with the world. Because sure, the foreign ministers, the Quad can get together and they can decide, oh, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, put out in a joint statement. But the people who carry out those policies and actually do those things exist within a bureaucracy that is being actively dismantled in some places. And this, the USAID is one aspect of this. But you know, the entire a large chunk of the federal workforce was offered what is sort of not really a buyout, but is called a buyout. There's this clear communication from the administration, from sort of the people who have Donald Trump's ears, your Elon Musk's, that the people in the federal workforce, their service is no longer required. You're no longer appreciated. So I certainly see things, you know, whatever policies the Trump administration settles on, the bureaucracy is what carries out those policies and puts them into play. All of that's going to go so much slower than it ever has before, because you're going to have a demoralized, smaller workforce. And that's by design. And it's just not like it's not logical if you want to get policies carried out, regardless of what those policies are. And so I think that's where we see this kind of link between domestic focused policies and all this domestic language that will have implications for foreign partners. Because if you're Japan and you are working with the United States on some joint project, if the people in your corresponding office, if there are fewer of them and they hate their jobs and they know their government doesn't appreciate them, I don't see that really working extremely well. That's a problem.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, this is, I guess, for those of our listeners who aren't in Washington, I mean, it is a demoralizing town, a time in town for anybody in the federal government. So I think you're absolutely on the money about that. And I mean, it's really kind of unprecedented, right? We've never seen this kind of a political siege on the bureaucracy, which obviously is being pursued a lot of this was talked about during the campaign. Mm-hmm. What wasn't talked about is, of course, Elon Musk, who, you know, we have not mentioned 12 plus minutes into this podcast, but is the central figure in implementing a lot of this. But you mentioned the Quad statement. Actually, I mean, this was I think one of the more absurd moments of the early, I think it was the first 48 hours, in which Marco Rubio, yeah, who was the first confirmed cabinet official, you know, he goes to this meeting, and then you just have this kind of ridiculous joint statement, in my view, which I commented on social media. And I mean, you know, the first paragraph of this joint statement is basically a paragraph that could have been written under the Biden administration, right? It's talking about the U.S. affirming a commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, you know, rule of law, democratic values, sovereignty and territorial integrity, like after an inaugural address threatening to annex the Panama Canal, basically, Trump talking about annexing Greenland, all of this stuff. And, maintaining convictions for international law, economic opportunity. And it's just, you know, you cannot take that seriously as something that is going to have any real carriage with the U.S. administration. I imagine for the other three Quad states, it was important to have something on paper post January 20th saying, hey, look, we have something on paper showing that the United States is still willing to play ball on these principles that the Quad has been pursuing, especially since the first Trump administration, by the way. I mean, the free and open Indo-Pacific concept comes from 2017 when Rex Tillerson was the Secretary of State under Trump 1.0. But looking at what's going on in Washington, I mean, a lot of that language just, I think, really rings hollow. So it was just, I think, a bit of a harbinger. And then, I mean, you know, let's linger on Marco Rubio for a second, right? Because it's really fascinating. I mean, you know, here you have a Secretary of State who, you know, I don't want to get too much into Rubio's personal biography, but Rubio was, you know, circa 10 years ago, a standard bearer for essentially what used to be the neoconservative view mm-hmm. within the Republican Party for the way in which the United States should engage in the world, to include Asia. And you have Marco Rubio, now Secretary of State, talking about essentially how the United States is now essentially in support of a multipolar world, right? I mean, you mentioned early on, Katie, how a lot of the language in Trump's inaugural kind of matches a lot of the U.S. adversarial critiques of what the United States does. I mean, Rubio's comments on multipolarity and the U.S. role in the international system could be out of, you know, a BRICS conference, right? I mean, he mm-hmm. is essentially, you know, he's openly talking about the end of unipolarity. He has said it is not normal for the world to simply have a unipolar power, and that, you know, multipolarity is where we are headed. And I think this is, I mean, in many ways, it's a historic thing for somebody in the position of the U.S. Secretary of State to talk about. It's also just really striking coming from Marco Rubio, who just was not anywhere close to this in the past. And so that, too, I think is going to start to cause some really strange reactions geopolitically in Asia, where allies are going to be asking some very tough questions, because the entire U.S. alliance system has really only coexisted in a world where the United States has been committed to hegemony, right? Including under a bipolar system during the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And so allies don't really know what this will mean, right? A multipolar world being embraced by the United States. Is that a world in which the U.S. still has any ambitions to have alliances or anything mm-hmm. like that, right? So far, we don't know the answer to that, because we've had kind of some alliance consultations. The national security advisors of Japan, South Korea, and the United States just spoke, and it was a pretty kind of normal-ish conversation about, you know, security problems in Northeast Asia. But this multipolarity talk, again, very much sending mixed signals to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, can you have a hub and spoke alliance system if the hub has decided it's not the hub anymore? And so, you know, if the U.S. isn't interested in coordinating those alliances in the future, then what happens? We shall see. I think it was interesting that, you know, within his first day, Rubio met with the Quad members. And as you noted, this sort of was an initiative that started during the Trump administration. I think we can probably expect to see the Quad much more China focused than it was it sort of trended into larger security issues and wider issues. I think we might see it sort of tighten focus. And then if we look at some of the other meetings, so Donald Trump's first foreign leader that he met was obviously Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But the second foreign leader he's going to meet is Ishiba Shigeru, who's in Washington today, the Japanese Prime Minister, who is at the head of a minority government and is not really attuned to Donald Trump's way of doing things. So
big risk for Japan, in my opinion.
So, yeah, it is a big risk for Japan. We'll see what that does, because, you know, Ishiba has his own precarious position, and Donald Trump is not a delicate figure, and so it's sort of bull in China shop. We'll see what that meeting yields. And then next week, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is going to be in Washington. I think that will be the third leader that Donald Trump meets with, and that they get along much more famously. I think that will be interesting, but India also has its own concerns. And so we see this sort of schedule of some of these meetings are with Asian partners. But again, Donald Trump's style is characterized very often as transactional. We'll see what it is that he demands from these leaders and whether they can get a word in edgewise, or if they're just here for a flattery, you know, or they're here to kiss the ring, see if they can kind of build some kind of relationship. Because regardless of how they feel about Donald Trump and his policies for the United States, they have to find some way to work with this guy and some way to get what their nations need out of this relationship. And so it will be really interesting to watch how those play out. I think just one more thing I want to mention is South Korea is sort of losing out on this because of its own domestic political turmoil, right? South Korea's president has been impeached. We'll see how that plays out, but most likely by this summer, there will be a new South Korean president, and that will have its own implications, but they're going to be late to the game because they really can't engage on the same level with an acting president.
Yeah, no, I think that's all right. I mean, I think the big concern for the allies is just making sure that the rugs don't get pulled out from under them, right? That Trump doesn't come in and start asking Australia to pay five times as much for Virginia-class submarines under AUKUS, that doesn't substantially demand revisions to the terms of the alliances with Japan and South Korea, so on and so forth. And it's particularly interesting just given that we're coming out of 4 years of the Biden administration, where it really was like, let's institutionalize alliances and try to essentially build up some stress tolerance for a Trump 2.0 world. So now I think that is essentially going to get stress tested. India, I think, is a really interesting case. And this is probably me signposting a thought that I do want to revisit on a future podcast, which is that in many ways, I think if the U.S. does head down this path that it does currently appear to be heading down, I think India's view of geopolitics and about the United States, about multipolarity and non-alignment and strategic autonomy in a very big way, I do think will actually be vindicated. This idea that, you know, you cannot essentially go all in on the U.S. basket of eggs, as much as you might agree with the United States about China and some other issues, due to essentially the inherent unpredictability, untrustworthiness of the United States and, you know, Indian skepticism about longstanding U.S. positions about the nature of the international order from non-proliferation to other areas, including trade, right? So a more transactional U.S. Is actually potentially a very good thing. So I think Modi will actually probably have a fairly reasonable experience with Trump. So, Katie, we're at risk here of taking this episode way too long because there is so much to talk about. But I do want to close with what I do think is really sending shockwaves across all of Asia, and not just for folks interested in geopolitics, but really for a lot of ordinary folks in the region, which is the dismantlement of USAID and the ensuing essentially, you know, I use that expression, the rug being pulled out, from aid programs, medical trials, humanitarian initiatives affecting hundreds of thousands of people around the region. Lots of USAID projects in South Asia and Southeast Asia that have come to a halt. This, I think, is obviously going to, you know, the big take that's been out there on USAID that I agree with is huge blow to U.S. soft power, right? Essentially something that, you know, is pennies on the dollar in a way for the U.S. taxpayer, not 25% of the federal budget, as some people think in the United States, but actually around one or less than one in most years, that has huge benefits for the way in which communities in Asia and around the world view what the U.S. is trying to do. But again, a huge coup for essentially longstanding critics of the U.S. being a little bit too forward involved in the internal affairs of other countries. So, you know, this decision has been celebrated in Russia, in China, so on and so forth. So really, I think a harbinger of how this nationalist turn is really going to start having impacts on how the United States is perceived in the world. And look, I mean, Asia is a complex region politically, right? We're not painting with a broad brush. We never do on this podcast. But for, I think, Asian states that do have some degree of democratic accountability to their own polities, I mean, it does matter how the United States is perceived, how anti-Americanism or pro-Americanism manifest in domestic politics. We've seen this, you know, prominently, I think, in even an ally like the Philippines, for instance, over the last 10 years in a real way. And I do think the ripple effects of what's happened with USAID are really going to ring in that particular sense. But what's been on your mind, Katie? I mean, particularly, you know, I know, you know, Central Asia, there's a bit of an angle here. So any reactions you're kind of seeing from that part of the world?
Yeah, so the Central Asia angle is very much focused on what happens with the U.S.-Russia relationship. Which hasn't gone anywhere. Donald Trump sort of famously on the campaign said that he would solve the Ukraine war in a single day. The war would be over. You know, he'd talk to Putin, they'd figure it out. They haven't met, and it's actually kind of funny to watch them, darkly funny to watch them dance around each other. Donald Trump came out with a statement, very, very bombastic and bellicose, saying, you know, there'll be more sanctions. You know, this is dumb. We need to solve this Ukraine problem. The Russian side, Putin has been sort of responded with flattery, while sort of his you know, functionaries in the commentariat and in the foreign ministry have sort of pushed back and said, you know, this is nonsense. And so there's this little dance. They haven't set up a meeting yet. Donald Trump is now saying, like, I need 6 months to solve this problem. And the implications for Central Asia of that relationship are pretty serious. So, you know, if Donald Trump has talked about, like I said, inflicting more sanctions on Russia. So if the Putin-Trump relationship doesn't get on an even keel quickly, and Donald Trump goes sort of fire and brimstone on Russia and enforces more sanctions, you can expect there to be sanctions on Central Asian companies in a way that the Biden administration was very delicate and diplomatic about how they meted out sanctions in Central Asia. There's certainly more companies they could have sanctioned, but they realized that there was a partnership and there was a nuance that needed to be attended to. I don't really ascribe a lot of nuance to how a Trump administration would do that. And so Central Asian economies could certainly suffer from that angle. There is sort of some optimism in the region that if the U.S.-Russia relationship can get on that even keel, it will work out for Central Asia. Central Asia feels like it can offer up, critical minerals to the U.S. and that kind of partnership. But I just think Central Asia is so far down on the rung of American priorities or interests that it's just they're not going to get to it. And so we shall see. I think there is a lot of waiting and holding breath to see how these things work out. Central Asia is very impacted by things that happen elsewhere. So if the price of oil and gas goes down, Kazakhstan loses a bunch of money. And so there are these implications that again, those secondary and tertiary implications of decisions that are made in other areas do have an impact in that region. The other sort of piece I want to pull on when we talk about USAID and also some of the, particularly the executive orders that pertain to U.S. foreign assistance and immigration, is the impact on Afghans and Afghan partners. I wrote a piece on this. People can go read it. We don't need to sort of harp on it too long, but the U.S. has essentially abdicated its commitment to people that fought on behalf of the United States in Afghanistan and has left these people stranded wherever they happen to be in the process by just default because of these immigration restrictions. And there's no, it is really sad to see, because there was some hope before the inauguration that the selection of people like Mike Walls to be national security advisor, he's an Afghan war vet, was seen as somebody who could be an ally for that group of people. They have done nothing. Marco Rubio has done nothing. He could accept, he could make exceptions for Afghans with the stroke of a pen with one phone call, and just is not doing that. I think that's very sad.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to provide three really big closing thoughts that are going to be unresolved on this episode, but we're probably going to come back to talk about this. But so the first one actually, I think, dovetails with what you were just talking about. And I think what you have been talking about throughout this episode, which is, I think a lot of what we're seeing in Washington that I think is terrifying both for Americans and for the world that relies on U.S. Predictability in the United States being essentially part of the load-bearing structure of the international system, is that parts of the U.S. essentially federal neural system, right? The way in which the federal brain, this complex organism, that is vastly complex, by the way, despite what you might have heard from Elon Musk, works, right? So they're basically switching off key functions and seeing what breaks. And eventually, either things will break so badly that we are in an unprecedented crisis, or they will slowly start turning things back on. But by then, it's going to be too late and the damage will be irreversible, right? I mean, a lot of these bells that are being rung, so to speak, cannot be unrung. And I think that damage has already been done I think USAID and immigration, I think, are two really good examples of that. So that's thought number one. Thought number two is that, and this one is for basically our listeners listening in Asia, which is that in a real way, I think countries do need to be ready for the United States essentially behaving like a rogue superpower in a real way, right? I think we've used that description in the past to talk about Russian behavior in the international system. The United States, I mean, talk of annexation, right, puts you squarely in that ballpark. And that's not euphemistic at all. I mean, that is quite literally what has been proposed by the President of the United States in official proclamations, right, at this point. So it is part of the universe of policy options for the United States. That also extends potentially to smaller and medium-sized countries. And the third closing thought is that in a real way, this could actually mean the era of great power competition as we have come to understand it is actually coming to a bit of a close, because it's not that the U.S., China, and Russia will see their differences evaporate. It's just that each of them will be a lot more focused on maximizing their preferences and interests vis-a-vis smaller and medium-sized countries rather than each other, right? And I think you already see that in the U.S.-China relationship. I'm going to stop there, because if I kept talking, we could probably go for another few hours, Katie. But I do think we will be back fairly soon with another episode to continue digging into what's happening in Washington, because I know it's of interest to a lot of our listeners in the United States and in Asia. I know a lot of them have questions. So if you do have particular questions about what's going on in Washington, we'll be very happy to take that on when we're back. But Katie, thanks a lot for joining me all the way from Hawaii. It's good to finally do an episode with you from with both of us being on opposite ends of the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, it is always nice to talk to you these things through with you and to our listeners. We'll keep paying attention to all of that's happening in the United States, and we'll be back soon with more.
Yep. Thanks for listening. Leave us a review if you haven't already done that. And as Katie said, we'll be back very soon with a lot more on the Asia Geopolitics podcast. Thanks for listening.